So what I'd like to do is read a Lamrim prayer from the Gold Prayer Book. And again, after lunch, afternoon, it's a little bit warm in the room. We've had lunch, so people get a little sleepy. So what's nice is sometimes I can read a prayer to... So we've talked about the first scope of the Lamrim, lower scope of the Lamrim. And you'll recognize some of the topics as we read this prayer. Let me just find these. If you're ever interested in getting ordained, just as a thing, and I'll talk more about that tomorrow of how I got here, there's a prayer on page 147, Practicing Guru Devotion with the Nine Attitudes. Tomorrow I'll talk a little bit about Guru Devotion for anyone who's interested. That prayer on pages 147 and 148 is a beautiful prayer to read every day if you really would like to... Rinpoche had said to get ordained. It's a really nice prayer. It's nice to read even if you're not. It's just a beautiful prayer. On page 137 is the foundation of all good qualities. This is our basic Lamrim prayer. And you'll start to recognize some of the topics we've been talking about. And we're going to be getting into some other topics. So I do want to talk about that. But I thought it's nice to kind of soak our mind in a scan of the whole Lamrim by reading this prayer. So feel free if you'd like to join in. Page 137. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure Guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and is difficult to find again. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly day and night takes its essence. This life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like a shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. Finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me always to be careful to abandon even the slightest negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. Seeking samsaric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness, and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the pratimoksha vows. Please bless me to accomplish this essential practice. Just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Please bless me to see this, train in supreme bodhicitta, and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. Even if I develop only bodhicitta, but I don't practice the three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. Once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzed the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. Having become a pure vessel by training in the general path, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, the supreme Vajra vehicle. At that time, the basis of accomplishing two attainments is keeping pure vows and samaya. As I have become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. Then, having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, by practicing with great energy, never giving up the four sessions, please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. Like that, may the gurus who show the noble path and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. Bless me to pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. In all my lives, never separated from perfect gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities of the stages and paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. Vajradhara is a primordial Buddha. The first verse that talks about correctly devoting to him, the guru, it could be him or her. It's just this was when the prayer was written in a time, male-dominated time like that. So I just wanted to explain that. And so I just wanted to talk now, and I wanted to also refresh you with this prayer book. In the prayer book, it contains, page 167 is called A Daily Meditation Practice on Guru Shakyamuni Buddha. So from page 167, and it goes to page 188, is an entire practice unto itself. It was made into a practice booklet. So some of you are here saying, I'm not really sure what to do on my own. How do I get my practice started? I'm interested in this tradition. What do I do? I tend to recommend people to this practice booklet. You can either order it online. It may be available as an e-document. It can be mailed. It might be available in England or through one of the vehicles here that you can get it. Or it's in this prayer book. So you could talk to Beth, because I asked her about the small Vajrasattva pocket booklet I wanted to get that they didn't have time to get. And she said she can give you a link to it, and you can link to it, and then you can have it. I happen to like the pocketbook because put it in your purse and put it in your pocket. But you can link, and sometimes we have to make some effort with the Dharma to try to figure out which prayers we want, print things out if you like. Some people can put them on their phones, and then there's no excuses. Okay? Then you can do purification. So do talk with her about making sure you get the link. And she may also have a way of connecting you to this practice or the practice booklet. So this is a complete practice for you. If you want to, you know, basically if you start on page 169, and Rinpoche even has this introduction about life is very busy in the West, right? We know that. So what he has here, if you look at page 169, is he says to set up an altar in front of your meditation seat. Again, you do as much as you can do. Don't try to do too much so that it never happens. And you go, I can't do that, I don't have the time. Beginning is just sit down. Then later, you explore, talk to a center. What are all these offerings? What does this mean? Some of you familiar with the water bowl practice? Some people not, okay? So these water bowls, they're just offerings. They represent offerings, okay? You can do them in any variety of ways. If you just look at this set of bowls from the left to the right, okay? From the left, water for drinking. Next bowl, water for washing or washing the feet. Third bowl, flowers, represents flowers. Fourth bowl, incense. Okay, so the first two bowls, water for drinking, water for washing, or washing the feet, is your joyous effort. That's one of the six perfections in developing the good heart. Joyous effort. Joyous effort is not just making effort, it's making effort at virtuous things, happily. Okay? So those represent joyous effort. Flowers, and if you have, so the first two bowls would be water, because you're offering water. That makes sense. The third bowl, flowers, if you want, put a vase of flowers on your altar that you like. Makes you happy. As soon as the flowers go off, you need to take them off the altar. You don't want to have dirty fruit and moldy fruit on the altar. Okay? Here they have lotus lights. No problem. It's flowers and light. Perfect. Right? You could put a big flower petal, a rose, in the water bowl for the flowers, or put it in all the bowls. Doesn't matter. So you can get creative. Here they use beans. Beans keep well. Like that. Sometimes people put rice in a bowl, and then they plunk the incense in the rice. It stands up. Okay? But after a while, you want to change them because they do get dusty. But want to keep the altar clean. Keeps your mind clean. Okay? So incense represents pure morality. Pure morality, your good conduct, like that, keeping the 10 virtues. The next one is a tea light, and they have a little light in there. It's nice to actually have a candle that you can light. You could have lots of lights. Here they have lots of electric lights. You can use Christmas decorations like that. No problem. Light, the light offerings represent dispelling the darkness of ignorance, emptiness. Emptiness. The next bowl after the light is scented oils. So if you want to spray your altar with a perfume that you like, or put some essential oil in the thing, or open it up so there's a scent, that's fine. Like that? You're enjoying this, yeah?
Yeah.
Some people really... It's interesting. Each person has different things they resonate with, okay? The next bowl is food, and you see they've got a pear. Brilliant. Okay? You can just put the pear on top of the beans. Food offerings represent... the scented oils represent your virtues. And there's variations on that. It's nice in Tibetan Buddhism. There's always variations. So we don't want to get the mind too rigid. You know, and I've seen students talking about this or no, it's like this. No, this is how it is. And, you know, so one time Rinpoche asked me to check about hand mudras, these rituals you do with your hands during certain practices, and they were very elaborate ones. So he said when the monks from Sarah Monastery come to our center in California, there's three Rinpoches and a Geshe that are coming, or two Geshes and a Rinpoche. And Rinpoche simply means precious or precious one. Okay, it's a title tagged on to the end of high incarnate beings. There's about 500 of them on the planet. Geshe is a PhD equivalent, a great scholar, and there's different levels of Geshe, so you can graduate with high honors and be a Geshe Larampa, or you can have other levels of Geshe lower, PhD equivalent. So, The food offerings represent meditative stabilization. And often there's another bowl, and here they have hand symbols that's used in a certain type of practice, represents music. Music would be the last bowl. And I've seen people that have a water bowl with rice in it and their favorite CD plunked in the top. But be creative. You want to make it joyful. Okay? So here they have lovely... like a glass type of bowl. So in the Tibetan tradition, you see these brass bowls like this. I didn't finish that story. There were two Rinpoches, two Geshes. Rinpoche said, ask the hand mudras. I sat them down in the Gompa. I had notes. I was going to take notes. We were going to take photos. How do you do the mudras? They had four different ways of doing it. Okay, so that taught me a big lesson of like flexibility. You know, and we all had a big laugh about it. Because one said, no, it's like this. The other one said, no, it's like this. No, you do the... So different reasons, different traditions. So the water bowls, you can do as elaborate or as simple as you want. You don't have to have them, especially when you're beginning. There is a way also to set them up. So we have another practice booklet, how to arrange an altar and how to actually offer. The point is not just to set them up. The point is to offer them. And then you get some merit offering them. So, you know, and you can play with it a little bit. If you light incense, you don't light the incense sticks on the altar. You would light them below, and you don't need a fancy incense holder. I have a bowl with rice, and I just plunk it in and put it to the side. I don't put it on the altar like that. And then you want to try to keep things neat, dusted, clean, and you can put whatever images you like, things like that. So I know sometimes for food offerings, I get these little candies that are gold wrapped, so it's like gold in the food bowl. I've sometimes had, we have candy in the States, these chocolate bars called Milky Way, one is called Mars Bar. So you put those in, it's like offering the universe. I got the Milky Way going, I got Mars, I got Earth balls. I mean, you want to be creative and have fun with it. Why not? So, one time His Holiness was coming to our center in California in 1989, right before he won the Nobel Prize, and it was Saturday night late, and we were setting up the stoop of the shrine, and Rinpoche said, I want water bowls, best have water bowls all around, and one of the nuns said, Rinpoche, where will we get traditional Tibetan water bowls now? Like, they're brass, the bowls, and they're actually okay, but you have to keep them polished. And Rinpoche turned and he said, in the West, you can have crystal. Like, why would we limit our mind? Like, you know? So we're so like, it has to be like this. And he's like, expand your mind, you can have crystal bowls. So Rinpoche's house in California, he's a house there, there's water bowls all over the house that are offered every single day, set up every day. Also, the reason these bowls are golden in color is there's saffron in them, and saffron also represents pure morality, and good saffron has a nice scent. And it makes some gold. So you're like offering gold like that. So you can play a little bit with the mind. And his house in Aptos has beautiful bowls all over. I mean, so what happens is the students in an area, when the house got set up, we were competing with each other to offer nicer water bowls to the guru. We were like, look what I got. I got these great, incredible goblets of, you know. So it makes it quite fun, you know, not competing in a negative way, but in a fun way. So it's really what brings joy to your mind. At my father's, I just have a little space on a table. And I looked for a long time. I went to thrift stores, charity shops, looking for, you know, people have crystal they're dumping. Mm-hmm. You can find, but I couldn't find something that fit, you know, that I couldn't find a set of them. They were, and then I just found these little Chinatown. Okay, they're not expensive, but they're flat, they're flowers, and they're very pretty. And it just fits perfectly. So, again, you do what's reasonable. You do what's reasonable like that. It can be quite fun. So it is nice. So why don't we, just to give you a little imprint, we make short offering of all the offerings, the light offerings, like this. Rinpoche likes, if you can, you can put your hands like this. And what I'd like you to do is I just want you to visualize for a moment, similar to what we did at lunch. These offerings transform into, imagine all the beings in the different realms. So if you were in a hell realm that is very hot, the offerings transform into cooling nectar, raining down on all the hell beings, relieving them of suffering. We also have freezing cold hells. So it's a warming sun, a warming beach, warm seawater, beautiful, pleasant, and it relieves these beings of their suffering, bringing them to ultimate happiness. And we think of the other realms. We've got animal realm, a preta realm where people are starving, and then our realm, the human realm, God realms. There's two God realms. But basically, imagine the offerings turn into diamond urns of transcendental nectar, relieving them of whatever suffering they have, bringing them to ultimate happiness. And imagine all the holy places you can think of, whether it be Buddhist or not. So I like to think of the stupas in Bodh Gaya. You don't have to have visited, you can see a picture of it. There's two stupas in the Kathmandu Valley. One is in a place called Bodha. It's the size of a city block. One is in on the other side of town called Swayambhu, up on a hill. So imagine that these diamond urns of transcendental nectar of our offerings, our good heart, all the love you've ever experienced, your good intentions, your prayers, your dedications, towering over all these holy shrines, all the temples, monasteries, nunneries, all the tankas and libraries and stupas and statues. And we offer. Just from your mind. And whatever merit we've created for making the offering, let's dedicate it to our quickly reaching a fully awakened state so we can be of the most benefit to all living beings. Thank you very much. That was the mini offering. It's nice to just get a little taste of. Centers set the bowls up, but they forget. The last offering, music, is your prayers and dedications. Prayers and dedications. And the other thing that's interesting is offering, technically generosity, it's the first perfection of the path of becoming a Buddhist saint, becoming a bodhisattva. There's six perfections, bless you. Generosity, ethical conduct, patience, joyous effort, concentration, and wisdom. And we've been talking a little bit about them indirectly, okay? But generosity is the first one because it's actually from which all the teachings flourish for you, where the practice comes from for you, which is why it's first. So on another level, when we think of generosity, we think of making offerings to people. And, you know, I just mentioned a thing about our monks and nuns organization, like that, but it's actually the cause of your prosperity. believe it or not, being generous. And it's very different than the way our cultures trained us. You know, some people have this saying, charity begins at home. So it's very different. And I had a long time as a fundraiser, raising money for politics, raising money then for Buddhist centers. And it's very hard when you ask people for money. It was very difficult, right? I felt guilty, right? But then I understood the enormous good it could do to help things. Yeah. And then when I started to honor it, I started to tell people about opportunities that I didn't feel. I was like, look, this is a chance. It's for you. This isn't for me. This is, you know, and then the centers just grew, flourished, developed like that. So it's very interesting because we have a lot of us I know in the States and England have very strange relationships with money like that. So people feel funny about it, you know, and it's interesting. So this practice I wanted to mention, any questions about water bowls or altars or anything like that? Okay. One other question I wanted to ask you, how many of you not familiar with how to make prostrations? I've never heard about how to make prostrations. Okay, I thought possibly not. Let me just give a quick, because I know there's some new people here. In the morning when I make prostrations, it's hard to do if you don't know how to do. So I totally understand that. When we make prostrations, so when you start, it's helpful obviously to be facing the altar, okay? And trying not to point your feet to images, but this room's surrounded by images, so you do the best you can do. It's okay. There's short prostrations, half, or long prostrations, full, okay? More merit, the more atoms of ground your body covers, the more merit, they say, okay? But basically, so if you're a very big, tall person, maybe more, you can also visualize you're on the top of a major mountain and your body's going down covering all the atoms below. We usually put our hands like this. Our prostration mudra has the thumbs in between. It's not a yoga mudra. The thumbs are in between like the jewel and the lotus. So they're never, so if it's like I'm always making an offering, my hands are never empty. Like that. Okay? And you start with the hands on your crown, and this creates a cause for you to develop an ushnisha. See, the Buddha has a crown protrusion? That's a sign of enlightenment. Now you might say, I don't want that thing coming out of my head. It's a sign of enlightenment. Okay, you wouldn't necessarily see it on enlightened beings, but it is a special sign. Ushnisha, crown protrusion. Then my hands at my forehead. Okay? This is basically me trying to purify, thinking about anything I've done negative with my body. Okay, so it's body, speech, mind. But here I'm also reflecting on all the bodies of the Buddha, meaning I'm prostrating to all the statues. Rupas are statues. Okay? Forms, all the forms. So I'm thinking about making prostration. You can visualize in your mind, if you're a good visualizer, all the statues, and endless numbers of me making prostrations. Okay? Speech. All the negativities I've done with my speech I want to purify. So I put my hands here, and I'm prostrating to all the texts, all the libraries, particularly the teachings on emptiness, like that. Put my hands here, purifying my mind, negativities I've done with my mind, and I am paying homage and respect to the statues, the stupas, the mind. Stupas are a shrine, and this represents the mind of enlightenment. So a stupa, this is stupa right here. This is a small stupa, and I think there's one also at the top of the landing in the window. And this represents the mind of enlightenment. It's constructed in a very specific way according to the absorptions of elements that happen in your body when you're dying. Stupa, okay? Earth, this part, water, fire, air, and consciousness, like that. So the thing, then it's like this. Let's see if I have some room here. If you do a short prostration, then I put my hands down first, okay? Then I touch my forehead. And you want to get up quickly to show you're getting quickly out of samsara, okay? When I put my hands down, the hands are like this. Not like this, not like this, right next to it, like this. I do put my hands down first, not to just drop to your knees, very hard on the knees. You're making a full-length prostration. So you can slide if you have a smooth floor.
And then I'm going to bring the light of the Buddhas over me,
granting me blessings and realizations. And then I tend to finish with, like that. Everybody okay? So slowly, you can try at some point. If you are watching other students, no problem. You just want to make sure they're doing it properly. And it's really actually a nice practice if you feel to do that. You're under no obligation to make prostrations at all. For those of you that like exercise, it can be helpful as well. Some people like to, and sometimes I've taken the lamas to doctors, and the doctors will say, do you get exercise? And they go, oh, I do prostrations. You know, they're clear that it's rigorous when you're doing a lot of them. You could do a practice every morning to this kind of picture. So in this prayer book, page 169, Rinpoche has set this up. He gives you motivations to think about. So you don't know what to say or how to motivate, you can just read that. Think about how extremely lucky I am that I have not died yet. You know, you might be a little shocked, but it's actually a good thing to think, like, I didn't die yet, I'm still here. I get another day to practice. So he leads you through some motivations. He, bottom of page 170 is prostrations. If you want to get up and make some prostrations there, and you learn prostrations and that's one of your things you want to do, that's a place you can insert it, or you can make three prostrations. If you don't understand a certain Sanskrit line, like on page 171, Om Namo Manjushriye, that's okay, you can just try to say, and then when you check in more to center and learn a little more, you add it in. So if it's something you don't understand, you skip it, go to the next thing. No problem at all. You can certainly ask students, teachers that come, how do I do this? How do I say this mantra? Okay? Guru Shakyamuni prayer and mantra, you can recite or not. Very nice prayer, just saying, please grant me your blessings. That's helpful. So then you have purifying the place at the bottom and blessing these offerings that go on to the next page. So what the significance of this is, we're going to do, this would set you up for a visualization of the Buddha with a practice. But you're basically, it's like you're inviting a special guest to come to your house, come into your space. So before you have people over, sometimes you clean your kitchen a little bit, dust the dining room. You set out some offerings, right? Oh, here, do you want some tea? Do you want some biscuits? So that's the same thing. You just want to get in mind that even though they're just statues and things, I'm actually inviting in special beings. The more you want to feel that they're real, I think the more it reflects in your practice, more benefit in the practice. So the mantra on the top of page 172, which is said three times, the extensive power of truth that follows, very, very powerful practice to expand the offerings and have them accepted just through visualization. So I might just light a candle. That's all I feel to do. I might say, slowly say this mantra out loud so I can learn it. And just maybe I don't understand all of what it means yet, but it's a very, very powerful mantra that multiplies the offerings. Imagine that light, that candle filling all of space, light offerings, helping me to have a better understanding of emptiness. You can just have that wish like that. And imagine all the statues, everybody's happy, blissful. Then it describes a visualization of the Buddha, and it discusses the symbolic meaning. Why are his lips red? Why does he sit on a throne of lions? What? So as best as you can, set up the Buddha if you like in front of you. We did Vajrasattva last night. We'll do that tonight. Okay, so another expression with the Buddha out there. Okay, and then it talks about, if you'd like to think about refuge, pages 174, 175, you could do a little refuge practice. Or, don't have time, you can skip it. Refuge is another one of our preliminary practices. Some people would like to build that in to their own practice. It's right there. Don't have time? Go on to the next thing. Page 176, Bodhicitta meditation. This is the heart of the Mahayana. So I'm going to work soon. I've got the visualization of the Buddha. I really want to think about living beings today. I was struggling yesterday. I just want to take that to work with me. So you look at this bodhicitta meditation. Maybe that's going to be a focus for you. You can change it up every day, too. But there's lots of variety in this. I don't have time for that, but the four measurable thoughts, beautiful, beautiful prayer. Wishing people, the first one is immeasurable equanimity. Immeasurable love, second stanza. This is page 177. Immeasurable compassion and immeasurable joy. The prayers are measurable based on it's limitless, those prayers. And you're sending them out to countless living beings. So the living beings are immeasurable. In the short form of the four immeasurables, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. So, in Tibetan. Are any of you Star Wars fans? Not much. I am shocked. Okay. Never mind, then. No, George Lucas, who made the films, is a Buddhist. So he made the cast of the original three films take Buddhist classes. It's all Buddhist principles about, going to the dark side. Like, may the force be with you, okay? The dark side is not bad, it's just your delusions. That's what Darth Vader's all about, okay? But in the end of the third film, The Return of the Jedi, is that one of the films? You didn't see the films, right? Doesn't matter to you. You saw them, okay, thank you. Somebody who's seen the light in here. No, they're just fun fantasy films. Anyway, they have these little teddy bear guys.
Ewoks.
Thank you. You saw it. Ewoks. Anyway, they're on these... they're flying through a redwood forest, computer-generated. So they're chanting the Four Immeasurables, clear as day in Tibetan. He put that in the film, in the original film. I don't know if it's in the digitized version, but... So anyone who went to that film, which in my day was millions of people, got an imprint of the Four Immeasurables into their mind stream. That's what you can do if you're a famous filmmaker and can have a popular film. Four Immeasurables, very powerful. So the short form... So this is a longer version, but there's a shorter form, just may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. You can find it easily online. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings have the suffering that's beyond suffering, immeasurable joy. Have the happiness that's beyond suffering. May all beings have equanimity, free from aversion to some and attachment to others. So you're in traffic in your car. You're getting frustrated. You're on a bus or a train that's late. You're waiting for somebody. Your mind getting a little squeezed. Four immeasurables. Fantastic practice. Easy to do. I'm sitting there. Frustrated. May all beings have happiness and cause of happiness. You see people in your office fighting, somebody you don't like, sitting at the conference table of the meeting. Here's the guy I don't like. Just think in my mind, may you have happiness and all the causes of happiness. Nobody needs to know I'm doing it. May you be free from suffering and all the causes of suffering. Just little easy techniques to use sometimes. It just makes things more gentle. So you can try. Okay, seven limb prayer on the next page. This is a very profound prayer. Seven limb prayer. Rinpoche explains the benefits of it right here. Okay? You've got paying homage or respect, making offerings, confessing non-virtues. We have confession in Buddhism, okay? Rejoicing at virtues. Rejoicing is the easiest way to create positive energy for yourself. You hear about somebody doing a retreat, right? And you just say, how wonderful. Genuinely feel that, you get some of the merit. You think about the people in Bodh Gaya in the winter season, making 100,000 prostrations. I'm never intending to go there. I'm not going to do that. Fantastic. They can do that. Somebody doing a pilgrimage. Wonderful. Right? So positive energy for your mind. If you're not a natural rejoicer, I was not. Right? You practice. Again, you practice. And eventually it starts. Initially, contrived. I force myself. I heard somebody's doing retreat, and I think, great. I was really like, I want to do retreat. Okay, but I practice, and I'd be like, great. How wonderful. Right?
Sure.
Slowly, but it started to come. It fake it until you become it, I'll say. We have fake it till you make it, right? Fake it until you become it. You practice. You rehearse. Now I hear that, and I automatically it comes. Great. Fantastic. So, again, you practice. It's possible to do. Possible to do. So that's a rejoicing in the virtues. Asking the Buddhas to remain, this is the bottom of 178, until samsara ends. The next is asking them to turn the wheel of Dharma. That just simply means teaching and dedicating all the virtues. Those are the seven limbs. Very powerful prayer. You can just recite the seven lines with some feeling. Mandala offering. Okay? Top on page 180. Mandala offering like this, some people do with their hands. It's a little tricky. Represents the universe, that's all. It represents the universe. Two fingers back to back are the center of the universe, Mount Meru, like an inverted mountain. These things here, as you see, are the four continents. We are the southern continent, according to Buddhist cosmology. Okay? You don't want to put your hands like this, you're not sure how to do, you can just think. Kind of, can I offer the universe the most incredible things I can imagine, and my practice? Best thing to offer, and all the love I've experienced, all the wonderful conditions I've had in my life, just imagine it multiplying, filling all of space. And you sometimes can read that verse 180, this ground anointed with perfume, it just represents the universe. Usually we do that before we would get teachings or something. And then the prayer of the three great purposes, you could read or not. About, you know, blessing my mind to work on a subtle level and a gross level like that. And then you come to requests. So requests are important, and we don't totally understand that in our cultures. People say, when I was at running centers, when's Rinpoche going to come back? When's this Rinpoche coming? When's that Rinpoche coming? We made many requests. I wrote formal request letters. There's a way to write them. I got cards, asked everybody to sign it. Sent many letters to Rinpoche. You know, that's what creates them to come. That's what creates, you have to create the cause. Like I said, I've been invited here to teach. I didn't just say, oh, Northern England in June, that sounds good. You know, I've been invited to teach, like that. So that you create the cause again. So these are some formal requests you can make, or put it into your own feeling. You know, I need help right now. I'm struggling to find a job. I need that, you know, can please help me? I want to practice more. I really want to get a consistent practice going. Please help me to limit distractions. Or whatever you say, put it into your own words. You know, I'd like a Dharma center to be near me. I'd like to move near a Dharma center. I'd like to, whatever you're feeling. Okay, and then you come to page 81, 181, is the prayer we just read, the foundation of all good qualities. So if you want to kind of have your mind re-familiarize with the Lam Rim every day, you can read it. You can read and stop at a verse if you'd like to analytically meditate on the Lam Rim. And you can stop at that verse and do a little 15-20 minute reflection, however much time you have. And then read the rest of the prayer. And you can read prayers quickly, too. You don't need to, you know, you can read if it's quickly, you don't have a lot of time, that's fine. Then you come to page 183. Request to descend. I have Shakyamuni Buddha in front of me, okay? Please come to my crown. I would like to do some purification. I'd like to receive the blessings. Just like Vajrasattva last night, aspect of the Buddha comes to your crown facing the same direction as you. And lower down on page 183 is Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra. Tayata, so TH is a hard T. Tayata, Om Mune, Mune, Maha, Muneye, and it's either Svaha or Soha. Both are fine. Tibetans do not have a V sound in their language, in their alphabet. So they say Soha. You can say Svaha. Both are fine. And while you're reciting that, we can do a few together, actually, just to give you the sound of it, but you can do it as quickly as you want, whatever. Nectar beams, imagine, are coming down from the Buddha's heart. Okay? Down, just like Vajrasattva last night. Maybe first white nectar beams purifying. Any obstacles I have to practicing. Any obstacles to connecting with the Dharma. Any obstacles to reading that book on emptiness. Purifying, purifying. Then, however long you want to do, while you recite the mantra, then golden nectar rays coming down, granting me all the blessings and realizations of the holy, omniscient mind. Let's try three mantras together, just to give you a sense of... Otayata as ever long as you have, and then you can absorb. The Buddha dissolves into a radiant drop of light through your crown to your heart. Okay, feel that oneness with that omniscient mind. Okay, page 185 are dedications. So again, to conclude, you had motivation in the beginning, dedication in the end. There's a whole practice right there. So again, you might find parts of it you like. Maybe you want to start a little bit more shine in the beginning. You can even visualize the Buddha in the space in front and do some concentration on him, on the visualization for a little bit if you like. If you want, you have to go to work. Do half the practice with a brief dedication. Go off to work. Come back, pick it up again. Finish and have longer dedications. Like that. Slowly you create a little bit. I just wanted to take the time to explain because... I know there's people, newer people here that haven't heard this and want to know what to do, so I thought it was worthwhile to talk about. Yes?
I just wondered how long, if you did the whole thing, would it take to do, if you did it in the morning?
It really depends on how long you're doing each section. Some people take longer.
Right.
I don't know a rough amount of this.
And that's also on the children guided meditation. And there's a short, which is about 5 minutes.
Okay, great.
And the long one, where you take time to meditate, 37 minutes.
So, you mean Shakyamuni Buddha practice?
The whole, what we went through.
So what we just went through, she has it on her. Oh, great.
Yeah, mandala offering.
Okay, so she, 5 minutes she does all that? Or?
There's one, it's very short, 6 minutes, I think.
Okay.
But it's quite short, so you read everything.
Yeah, so you can read things more quickly. And then, so I would say probably it would be nice to give yourself a half an hour to just, you're not going to get it all in, but you could certainly read through it in a half an hour.
You'd need to do the meditations, wouldn't you?
Well, I'll put it this way. It's up to you, because I know people that like to meditate, that's their main thing, and not say prayers. So they basically visualize through the prayers more quickly to get to the meditation. I know people that don't like to meditate. That's not their thing. So they like to do the prayers. They that does something to them. So again, it's each of us coming to it from our own way of what's speaking to us. And slowly you start to build a practice. When you get a little bit more time one day and you're off from work, then maybe I try both and I get some prayers and I like that prayer. I'm going to read that and I'm going to read it with some feeling and then I'll meditate on it. And that would be great, like that. So I think it varies. So again, there can be a shorter version. You could do even more quickly. And then you have more time. You said the other one's 35 minutes to roll out?
Yeah, 37 minutes. Yeah, because you can do a short and then you do shine meditation and you go into the numbering. So it's, depending on what you want to do.
Great.
But I found the 37 minutes incredible.
It's very nice.
Yeah, very powerful.
So there you have something like that. And this, clearly you could get in to close to that, I would think, based on, I want to have more time to meditate today, so I'm going to do these prayers more quickly. No problem, like that. Because what it's doing is it's leaving an imprint in your mind. That's what's happening. And it's kind of like this very virtuous thing. Initially, we don't have much experience about it. You know, I'm like, oh, this is a hassle. And, but it starts to leave an imprint, and then you start just having a habit of this. Oh, no, I got to do my practice. I want to do my practice. Oh, then I'll do the other stuff I usually junk around with in the morning. But I want to get that practice done. So it really starts to manifest like that. Any other questions about that? Thank you. So I want to, I can't believe how fast this is going. It's fast, isn't it? I just want to talk very briefly about suffering, the middle scope of the Lam Rim. I'm not going to dwell heavily on it because I want to get to Tonglen. And we also have tomorrow, and I want to talk about emptiness and things. So between today and tomorrow, we'll manage some of those. The suffering is the middle scope. To know there is an end to the suffering, first you have to explore the suffering. And we call them the three, the six, and the eight. Three kinds of suffering, six kinds of suffering, eight kinds of suffering. I think you have some idea, for instance, the cycle of samsara, birth, old age, sickness, death. Birth, old age, sickness, death. All of that is suffering to some degree. I think we're aware of that. Okay? So we understand those four sufferings. We also have sufferings of things you're aware of loneliness. We know what that's like. There's a suffering of uncertainty. You can't count on anything in samsara. Nothing at all. So we sometimes get hooked by something. I know she's going to show up. You know, I know when I get to my office, the computer will be there. And one day I get there and it's not there. Uncertainty. Somebody broke in or some... It constant in samsara. Okay? There's this unstable basis. There's also a suffering of dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction. You know, you get the ice cream cone. It's so exciting. The first lick is very different than the last lick. Sometimes you're tired of it already. Oh, I'm feeling, I shouldn't have gotten such a big cone. You know, everything's this dissatisfied mind with everything in samsara eventually gets tired, it gets tainted. So we explore the different sufferings. Then when they talk about the three sufferings, we have blatant suffering that we're all very familiar with. You have a headache. You break your leg. You get the flu. We understand that. More subtle version is called the suffering of change. That's the second of the three sufferings. Suffering of change. We mistake a lot for happiness. We mistake for happiness. So you're seated in the sun, and on Friday it was kind of cold and rainy. Thursday in particular. So then the sun came out, and it's all, this is great. You go out and you sit in the sun, it feels really good. I kind of a little bit impute on the sun, oh, this is happiness, this is great. Well, if it's a true source of happiness, the way a true source of happiness works, the more you experience it, the happier you get. Okay? So you're sitting in the sun. Suddenly, it's too warm. It's too warm. I'm a little bit too warm. So I change, and I move to the shade. Okay? And I misinterpret. And now the shade is really delightful. This feels really good. Okay? So I misinterpret. Okay? The only little level of happiness was the change. Was the change. The shade is not ultimate happiness. The sun's not ultimate happiness. Not a true source of happiness. After a while, the shade will get cold, and I'll move back into the sun. There's all this changes that causes the suffering is there. And this isn't working, this isn't working. You impute on chocolate. You know, it's a true source of happiness. So the more chocolate you eat, the happier you'd get. It doesn't work that way. You get sick. Like that. We impute it on other people. I'm going to be in relationship with you so you can make me happy. Nobody can make you happy. It has to come from here. So slowly you explore, and I just wanted to mention, I think I talked about this in London. From Samsara's Nature. This is from a favorite Pema Chodron book, Living Beautifully with Uncertainty and Fear, I think it is. It's a very, very nice, and it's Uncertainty and Change. It's a really nice book. Her titles are great. Living Beautifully with Uncertainty and Change. How's that going for you? Uncertainty and change, right? Can you live beautifully with it? You know, are you no problem? It's great. So she talks about in the first chapter something called the fundamental ambiguity of being human. Fundamental ambiguity of being human. Okay, what does that mean? It means that as human beings, we're flawed. We make mistakes. Again, I'm not laying a trip on you and getting down on you. I'm just facing reality. I know this about myself. I'm broken. Okay, and I'm okay. But I acknowledge and I accept my mistakes. I didn't used to. So I would squeeze myself. You need to be perfect. You need to, you know, it's not possible. I'm striving to become a Buddha, but I'm not a Buddha yet. Okay? I'm giving it my best attempt to do it, and I'm okay in that path. Sometimes I make a mistake. So I pick myself back up, hope that I can glean the lesson, and I continue forward. It's like two steps forward, one step back. Two steps forward, one step back. That's the spiritual path for me. But I continue to move forward more. Okay? I acknowledge my brokenness, that I am flawed. Makes me more human with others because I can see the challenges they have. When I didn't accept it myself, then I'm holding you to a higher standard. So you mess up and then you're stupid and you're an idiot. It's not like that. We're all human beings here on the planet together. Trying. Wanting to be happy, not wanting to suffer. Suffering from delusion. We're all similar that way. And she talks about in the nature of samsara from Suzuki Roshi, the great Zen master. Life is like stepping into a boat that is about to sail out to sea and sink. Okay. How are you with that? My eyes open with that? Is it, you know? Sometimes life is like that. And so she says, how can we live wholeheartedly in the face of impermanence, knowing one day we're going to die? Okay, and here's another thing. When I mentioned, we kind of put things off and we have excuses. I mentioned this yesterday. When I get my kid goes off to university. You know, when I get the new job. Once I get the car fixed, then everything's going to be okay. You know, I'm going to get the kitchen redone. You know, once I get that sorted with the mortgage and I pay that back, then everything's going to be fine. Okay? I say this as well, and she has it in here. What is it like to know you're never ultimately, finally going to get it all together? You can let that go now. You're never going to have it all together. Okay? Doesn't mean you can't be a Buddha. Doesn't mean you don't strive for that perfection when you'd have it all together. But then it won't matter having it all together. You're beyond that as a Buddha. So the thing is, we do move along with our practical reality. You participate in it. With karma, I think about people say, do I have choices? Is it free will? You have to participate in your karma. Meaning, you're faced with choices constantly. People in our cultures have a multiplicity of options. Multiplicity of options. Sometimes too many options. So you face the choices. I weigh them all the time. What's the most beneficial thing for me to do here? What's the most beneficial way for me to respond to this person? What's the most beneficial way for me to be here on the train platform? What's the most beneficial? How should I do my teaching schedule? Is it better to go there then, or should I be there and then? Constantly there's decisions. Some are more blatant in your face, and some are just little subtle things that you just move along. And until you build your wisdom and compassion, so that better informs you the choices. That so we try as much as possible to open our eyes, be as awake as possible. And I just found it so much easier to know I'm never going to have it totally together. So it doesn't mean I don't do my things or clean out the closet, or I'm moving through my dad's house now, cleaning out. You know, slowly, because I have the time. Fortunately, no emergency. It's not suddenly like we need to sell the house yesterday. We have time. We might have a year or two or longer. But there's things that if it does come quickly, there's certain things you might need to have a few weeks to sort. You know, he has a musical instrument we were going to sell that it needed work on it. So until I found the guy, till I got it over to the shop, till I picked it up from the shop, you know, my sister and my record collection. Can you imagine? There's a market for vinyl. There's a big market in England for vinyl. They said you can, the guy said you can get more money in Europe. I'm like, how do I get the records there? You kidding? So I sold them in the States. Somebody came to the house, took them all away, and left me money for them. I was stunned. Right? My sister and I thought we'd just leave them out by the street for the trash. I couldn't believe it. Right? So, but it takes time till I got the guy, till he had time. He said he'd come to the house, there's enough records. I wanted to marry him. You're coming to the house and taking them away from me? I thought I have to take them to Center City, lug these crates out of the car, you know, that I could barely carry, and then somebody picks out two and goes, I'll take these two. No, now there's a market. I found 15 places in the area that I live that wanted vinyl. Okay? Interesting. So you move along. You do what you can do. Okay? Is it possible to increase your tolerance for instability and change? Because that's what's going to show up. So if I'm practicing again, I mentioned, with the small changes, how will you get with the bigger changes? So I just wanted to mention a little bit about something to think about. And the other thing I was thinking is, there's a number of people I'm reading right now, and you know how sometimes you pick up a book, and then another book you pick up close by, not referred to in that book, but just mirrors the other book, and then another book is... they're similar. So I was reading Archbishop Desmond Tutu, his book of forgiving, and a senator from the state near me, New Jersey, a young senator. This is hopefully the future of the hope in the United States. This man wrote a book. And then there's another man doing political justice work for poor people in the States, getting them off death row, poor people that didn't have proper representation. All three of them, in their ardent work with social justice, came to the same place at one point. Utter frustration and despair in their work. People were being executed in the States, and the guy couldn't do anything about it because he didn't have any more money, didn't have any more lawyers, overworked, right? The same thing with the senator when he lived in a impoverished city outside New York City in a massive drug tenement, trying to do community organizing to help clean up the neighborhood for the people that live there, you know, and just overwhelmed at one point with the work and the frustration and the things like this. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the same with the work in South Africa at times, right? So they came to a place where they gave up and they quit. His Holiness has a famous poem about never give up, right? He lost his country, right? Never give up. So they came to a place... utter despair and quit. One of them broke down in his office sobbing, hanging up with the death row guy that's about to be executed. Just, I can't do this anymore. Can't do it. Done. And somehow they each had an insight that we're all broken. They're not so different than the death row guy and the drug dealer and the, you know, the people that were torturing people in South Africa. We're all broken. Okay? How to overcome that is you have to face the pain and go through. Face the pain, and I'll add, and the joy, and move through it. You can't deny it, ignore it, bottle it up, run from it. It's going to show up at some point. So again, the discomfort, facing my discomfort with some mindful practice, using my breath that's always happening, it's just like this. I'm okay. We will get through this. People have suffered unbelievable traumas. One of my friends losing her husband suddenly, lost her aunt, lost her sister, all within like a month's period. People said, "Well, I don't know how you keep going." She said, What are the alternatives? Right? So you just face each day. Some days glory, some days wonderful. Some days not going so well. Okay? Going through and in my brokenness, I can acknowledge everybody else's brokenness. When I face my own pain, my own fears, myself, I'm much better able to reach out to you. When you go, I'm suffering, I'm lonely, I'm this, I'm that, like that. So something to think about. I find it's really the path to having a meaningful life. Is we can't avoid anymore, you know, like that. So It can, and then through that path, you see more joy as well. There is a lot of joy, a lot of people helping. Or you can choose to come from a negative mindset. And for me, and did you ever notice when you're in a bad mood, everything reflects back very ugly. You're in a bad mood, and everybody is just a jerk and in my way, and, you know, all the lights are turning red, of course, because I'm late. And, you just see. And then some days, happy, spacious. And even the jerk at work is okay. That possible. Okay. So it's one of the things I do at Dharma centers. They don't know at night I go around with oil and I oil all the doors. Nothing for me like a creaky door. It's really like, okay. So I want to talk about the heart of the Mahayana tradition. The heart of the Mahayana tradition. What else can I do when I'm feeling overwhelmed and I'm trying to practice mindfulness and I'm trying to build a practice of meditation? It's frustrating. The heart of the Mahayana is our teachings on bodhicitta. Bodhicitta. Bodhi, enlightenment, again. Citta, mind, the mind of enlightenment. So we are trying to cherish others more than ourselves, and we have two main methods to develop this awakened, fully awakened heart. Two main methods to develop bodhicitta. So one method was prevalently taught, very public, called six-point cause and effect method. And one method was private and secret, called equalizing and exchanging self with others. And I want to talk about that method right now. We'll talk about the other method tomorrow. So it was secret. It's a little bit like radical compassion. Both of the methods begin with equanimity. Equanimity. So this is a really helpful tool in, I think, lending meaning to life. Lending meaning to life. I'm just thinking, do we want to do this meditation first or the other meditation? So, in lending meaning to life, equanimity is equal regard, equal respect for all beings. Okay? Whether they harm you or help you. That's the tricky part. So how do I stay open to somebody that harms me or my family or my friends or my environment or my country? Okay, it's difficult like that. So we start first with people that we know. Okay, and there's a famous meditation called friend, enemy, stranger. Friend, enemy, stranger. I believe it's in the How to Meditate book. You can find it online as well. Friend, enemy, stranger. There's different couple variations on how to do it. But you can put three people in front of you. A friend, somebody you don't get along with, an enemy. You might not say, I have an enemy, but somebody who's challenging. And a stranger. Stranger is somebody you may know their first name, but you don't know a whole lot more about them, and you don't have an opinion one way or another. Friend, enemy, stranger. Okay? So you consider the friend and all the wonderful feelings you have, and isn't it great, and it's easy. Okay? With my friends, another thing to note, I'm not really doing that much work because it's easy with them. Okay. Any of your friends now, when you first met them, you didn't get on? Anybody have that experience?
Yes.
Yeah. My last boyfriend was like that. Okay? Then isn't it interesting that you had a friend, you moved in with them, a lover, unbelievable. Some people had kids with them, right? And now you never want to see them again, and they've moved into another category. It's all interchangeable, isn't it? Here you got an enemy, now you're holding this person as enemy. They're other, different, I don't really want to see them, difficult person. I wonder about one kind gesture towards this person. One sincere compliment could shift the whole thing with that person. Just creating healthy relationships, it's possible. I've had that happen with a guy in one of my offices. Nobody liked him. Very difficult person. I was very afraid of him. I was the new person hired. Had to do a project with him. So slowly over time, I was a new Buddhist trying to... I got him a cup of coffee one day after a lot of, you know, worried, and got him a cup of coffee. Found out how he took the coffee before. Found out and disarmed him. Would you like a cup of coffee? Cream only, right? No sugar. Because I was watching the people in my office. I learned bodhisattvas, they know how everybody takes their tea and coffee in the office. So I did an exercise. Try this. Again, this is you exercising. Please investigate, I said, what I'm saying. Please try it on yourself. I heard these Buddhist teachings. There's bodhisattvas, and one bodhisattva can find out how people take what they drink in their office. So I went around. I was like, I'm at the coffee machine. Oh, she puts a lot of sugar in it. Okay. Then I see the mean guy. Cream, no sugar. So I registered it. A week later, I got up the nerve to ask him if he wanted a cup of coffee. I made it natural. Came in his office. I came in with my empty mug. Had to drop something off. Oh, here. Oh. Would you like a cup of coffee? I'm going to the coffee machine anyway. You know, I was shaking. You know, in there. He didn't know. It took me 2 weeks to get the right time when his cup was empty. His cup had to be empty. And I said, cream, no sugar? And he's like amazed. Somebody knew. He's like, couldn't speak for a moment. He said, okay. Gave me his cup. I went out and made a really nice cup of coffee like I would for anybody. Made no big deal. Here you go, enjoy. That was it. We were friends after that. That was it. Simple gesture. I had people in the office asking me, what did you do? He likes you. Which I said, I got him a cup of coffee. Right? Simple, can be simple stuff. Enemy shifts. Suddenly, I had a stranger on Lisa. Lisa worked in our local health food store in our little town. And then I went off to do 7 months retreat at the center. But I wasn't in town anymore. I was on my cabin. So I use Lisa every once in a while in a meditation as my stranger. Lisa. I didn't know much about Lisa. I just knew her first name. Saw her in the store. Nothing. 7 months later, I come out of retreat. I go to the health food store. There's Lisa in one of the aisles. Right? She didn't know 7 months I'm with Lisa. She's my stranger. Right? So I see her. How interesting. I was amazed at my mind. I'm all excited to see her. All excited. And I'm heading down one aisle, and I'm like, you know, you come out of your retreat, you're all soft and gushy. You know, no, the world has no edges. Come out of retreat, I see her down one of the aisles, and I'm like, Lisa! I said that to her, And then, because you're all open, your heart's just, like, in love with the world. I mean, sometimes you come out of retreat like that. So I'm a stranger to her. She knows I come into the store, but... So she's at the other end of the aisle, like, hi. She's like, whoa, what is this coming down the aisle now? What is? And then I suddenly remembered, and I kind of pulled everything in, and was like, I haven't seen you once. She goes, oh, I haven't seen you in months. What? You know, I said, I was on retreat, and then we started talking, connecting. So she, for me, had moved over into the friend category. So happy to see her. But then you share a little bit in the aisle, and the next time I saw her, she's all like, hi, how you doing? Well, you know, so it's interesting. Friend, enemy, stranger. Equanimity. You know, so can I just at least keep my mind open in the face of different people? People especially I feel that are other. Some people we're afraid of. So you be practical and be cautious. We have to be cautious right now in the world. There's some trouble in the world. So you don't just go to every street person, come in, you can live with me. That doesn't make sense. That's not possible to do that. You have to be a pretty unique person to do that. Mother Teresa maybe could do it. I don't feel comfortable doing that in New York City. And there's people all over the street there. Okay? So, but at least, what's my regard for them when I see them on the street? I look at them. I might engage them in a conversation. They're not like garbage to me. I see people walk by, I don't know. You know, uncomfortable. No, there's a person there. It's a human being. In the winter, it's horrible. Freezing on the street, right? You can give them money, buy them food, can ask them what they need, like that. Sometimes just a little focus, like this. So equanimity. Based on this, then you have two things. You want to reflect, these two points are together. You want to reflect on the disadvantages of cherishing yourself. The other point is you want to reflect on the advantages of cherishing others. I think we're pretty clear about that. Just think, take your break, think about When I'm not happy, this is something you can do from here on out. When I'm not happy, what am I thinking about? What am I focused on? For the most part, you will find that you're sitting in your mind. It's about me, myself, and I. I, me, mine. That's the most important thing. Okay? And when I'm really feeling spacious and happy, I'm usually contributing something to somebody else, helping somebody else. More patience, more expansion, more something. Somebody needs, oh, I can take a little bit more time, help somebody. You check like that how it works in your mind. So the Buddhist teachings list a whole, you know, they're like this, and self-cherishing creates that. But all your suffering can come from there. Self-cherishing, self-absorption, selfishness, it's all the same. Traditionally in Tibetan Buddhism, they call it self-cherishing, cherishing the self. Third point. Well, first you have equanimity, and then you have the other 2 points. The next step, because some count equanimity as part of the parts and some don't, the next step is you do the exchange. Do the exchange. What does that mean? Exchanging self with others. Okay? You're not going to become someone else. It's an attitude. It's an attitude. We have the expression in our cultures, put yourself in someone else's shoes. It's like that. Can you look out through their eyes? The guy in my office, very, very miserable. Right? For a week I considered him. I was new, but for a week I was like, I have to do this project with him. God, he seems so angry. Okay? So analyze. When you get angry, any idea what's beneath your anger? Anybody in touch with this? What's underneath your anger?
Fear?
Yep. Fear's one of the things for sure.
Your needs not getting met.
Needs not getting met.
Self-cherishing.
Expectation.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I often find, too, for me, anger, sad's bodyguard. That's how it works with me a lot. Sad's bodyguard. You know, I'm a little bit tweaked. You know, then you're going to posture yourself. So there's a lot of things under anger. All these things you mentioned are under there. Okay, and if you want to look at fear as well, analyze your fear. You get anxious about something, worried. Buddhism says, please analyze. We don't repress stuff. We don't deny it. We don't lash out. Look at your fear. It starts dissolving when you look at your anxiety and your fear. There are things on the planet sometimes we have to worry about and be concerned. There's certain neighborhoods in Philadelphia. As a white person, I cannot go at night. It is extremely dangerous for white people and black people. Okay? But I'm not going to be stupid and take myself to a neighborhood like that. So you be practical. But underneath fear, so if you really have some ruminating fear, some people have, you have to look at it. What's underneath it? What do you think's underneath your fear and anxiety? Anybody have any thoughts on that? If you suffer from fear and anxiety,
could be a trauma from years before that surfaces in anxiety.
Sure, yeah.
Rejection.
Yeah. Rejection. Could be like that. You can even look deeply into the trauma. Look into the rejection. Because we say, but I was rejected. If you're okay, so you wake up in the morning. I've done this work with teenagers. So they break up. Every 2 weeks they break up with another person. They're together and then they break up. We've all been through this. My friend says, I'm rejected. He rejected me. Okay, you woke up in the morning. How'd you feel this morning? I felt really good. He broke up with me today. You felt good in the morning. Okay? You're a good person? She goes, yeah, yeah. You feel good about yourself? Yeah, I feel good about myself. I said, I know that volunteer project you're involved with. I was so inspired by that you did it. She goes, yeah, I love that. I'm really great. You're still doing the project? I'm still doing the project, right? So you're this good person. You're okay contributing, being a contributing member of the world. That's pretty cool at your age. That's great, you know? Then he broke up with you. Now everything's flipped on its side. You're not the same person you were when you woke up this morning? You're still doing all those things. So we have to write the picture. But suddenly, this person doesn't want to be with me. You don't want to be with someone who doesn't want to be with you. People have different karmic paths going on. I'd like to be with them and it makes me sad and it's unfortunate. Absolutely. You can be sad about it. But suddenly she's telling herself stories. She's not good enough. Nobody likes her. She's useless. She's worthless. She's not okay. She's still doing all those other great things she's doing. Just one person can bring you down like that. So again, you have to investigate. What is the rejection about? Then trauma comes in. That can be more serious.
Isn't that, though, about sort of old, you know, like an old story about yourself that gets triggered again by
sure.
rejection?
Sure. And you just acknowledge, oh, that's that story. I had that many times with, oh, there's that voice again. When I'm in this setting, so after a while, I recognize the voice that's not accurate, telling me old stories about myself. I keep recognizing it. Thanks very much. You know, I don't need you anymore. I'm not that anymore. I'm not this person. I know many years you identified me. You defined me. I'm not there anymore. Yeah. There are people, particularly members of your family, you may notice, they don't want you to change for the better because you fulfill that role in your family. So everybody knows how to bump up against each other in a certain way. You start to change, it threatens everybody else, and it threatens that posture of stuff. It's very interesting. So sometimes people hold you hostage that way. I've noticed that when I lived in California for years I haven't been there, but I come back and I teach, and I can see sometimes, somebody said something to me the other day when I was out there, and I looked, and the woman with me, she goes, that's interesting, she goes, you're not like that anymore. It's funny how they have this old view of you, and I'm like, well, they haven't seen me in 10 years. So obviously that identify that, but I'm okay. I'm where I am now, and I just acknowledge they haven't seen me in 10 years, so they're operating with an old Amy. That's okay. I don't have a problem with that. It reminds me of all the great work I've done on myself to get here. So it's interesting. That. Sometimes I find underneath fear is loss of control. Loss of control. We have a great fear of death and that we won't have control in death. How do you have more control at the death time? Practice Dharma. Practice Dharma now. Control's a big one for people. So I don't want to rush our Tonglen meditation, but so when you do this exchange, we're going to do a little bit tonight before the Vajrasattva. When you do the exchange, exchanging yourself with others, it's an attitude again. So I'm a little bit, I see the street person on the thing and I just think, wow, like how, like really to get into their experience with them, what is it like to be living in New York City in February on the street? It's freezing cold there, you know, and they're on the street. You know, what is it like to be the grumbly guy at work that everybody was afraid of? I wonder what his experience is like. You know, wonder what it would be like to be him. You know, when I got to know him, became friends with him, I could see he was terrified of everyone in the office, like a chained dog. You know how they growl at you, but they're really terrified. Like that, he didn't know how to socialize with people, partly from his background, and could see that that was just a response, like that. So doing this exchange, then the other thing you can think about is, roughly, I'm just curious, how much, what percentage of your day, any day, would you say you spend thinking about yourself, doing for yourself? What percentage?
100.
100, that's pretty honest. Pretty close, right? I'd say pretty close. It's a high percentage. What if you took half of that? Let's say 50% of your mental energy and all your activities that you do for yourself, what if you took 50% of it, directed it towards others? That's your activity in the break time and this evening. The activity is, can I direct that focus towards other beings? Now, it doesn't mean that everybody's like, no, you first at the tea. No, you first. No, you first. I mean, be practical, but it's an attitude that thinks of others first. That thinks of others first. It's always me first. It's always me going through the space first. Just see if you can try to move the mind into somebody else's experience. Very challenging to do. You just practice. You just try. Exchanging self with others. The last step is Tonglen meditation. Okay? Taking and giving. Taking and giving. Okay? Actually, no, we have a meditation thing, so we're going to do it in the meditation. Taking and giving. So basically, you're taking the suffering of others. I described it a little bit before. I have a constricted knot of my selfishness and self-cherishing at my heart. It's only going to chip away and purify there. From a place of deeper peace and happiness, because I'm reducing my self-cherishing, I offer to living beings, and I'll set up a visualization for you when we come back from the break. Let's see what time. Yes, great. So Tonglen meditation. And then there's variations on Tonglen. And I like to build it up slowly and start with a visualization of myself first. Very helpful to start with yourself. Most people leave yourself out of the equation. We have to do some Tonglen with ourselves. So if you're going through a very challenging period in your life, do Tonglen with yourself. Take the suffering of the front visualization. If you have a challenging person in your life, it's a very powerful meditation to do with them in regard just to them. I've actually found it shifting energy with them. Do it with a good motivation, with as much concentration as you can, as best as you can. It can be very short. If you only have 5 minutes, it's okay. If you have longer, you can do more elaborate. So we're going to build up the visualization till we're thinking about all living beings. But you can't start that way. You have to slowly build it up to consider doing it with individuals like that. Taking and giving. You can do it by someone's bedside. They're in the hospital. No one needs to know you're doing it. I've done it many times beside people's bedside. I've done it at meetings where I'm furious with someone. And I'm just like, okay, really challenged by this person. I've done it when I'm with a friend who's crying, or I see somebody in distress, you know, in the subway, and I see somebody in distress, I can just sit there and do Tonglen. I do it when I check into the news in the morning, my phone. Tonglen meditation. Fire in London. Tonglen meditation, right? Now there's fires in Portugal. Right, like that. Slowly. So taking and giving. Any questions about anything like that? Okay, we're going to take a break. And we come back at 5:15, then we'll do a meditation. So let's take 20 minutes. Remember?